feeling we can't handle. Addiction is an attempt to use something, anything, to cover up a feeling, maybe even emptiness inside you. Ask yourself, is it food that's filling up the emptiness? Is it alcohol? Is it gambling? Is it drugs? Or maybe it's that relationship that is bad for you. Or, do you always have to rescue people in need? Or, is it the continual buying of things, saving and collecting or storing things in your house? Whatever it is, we all have to come to grips with those elements in our lives that have gotten out of control like weeds in the garden. Drinking, eating, relating, whatever it is that is addictively filling up the emotional and spiritual emptiness. We often use drinking, eating, sex, pills, gambling, excessive working, excessive anything to give us a love reward we don't have inside of us. The brain chemistry for addiction is the same for love and reward, for self-nurturance, and the connection with the divine. According to Louise Hay, addictive behavior is another way of saying, I'm not good enough. When you get caught up in this kind of behavior, what you're really trying to do is run away from your feelings. Think about it. The next time you eat too much popcorn or troll Facebook for too many hours yet again, or spend too much money on shoes or clothing you don't need, or whatever your addiction is, what are you escaping? At first, your go-to addiction is very rewarding. It really hits the spot. Whether it's that first cigarette, that first drink, the first time you had sex with that person, the first time you pulled that lever on the slot machine, you felt that thrill. Then, of course, you find yourself doing more and more of the behavior and feeling less and less of the thrill. That's because the hallmark of addiction is you build up tolerance. The same amount of drinking, sex, buying, or eating gives you less and less relief over time. So, you have to use more and more to get the same effect. But what's worse is you can't stop. If you stop drinking, buying, eating, or having sex with that person, you feel awful. You go through a kind of emotional and physical withdrawal with painful symptoms of emotional and physical distress. We usually think that addiction or abuse is just a psychological problem. No. Addiction rewires our brains, whether it's alcohol, cocaine, gambling, or sex. Unwanted changes occur in our brain and our body, our psyche, and our spirit. Circuits in your brain that function for relationships, work, learning, and so on, those brain pathways get taken up by acquiring your go-to substance. Literally, your brain gets hijacked by your addiction. So instead of you getting love and fulfillment through family, relationships, work, and so on, your time and your brain chemistry gets taken up by your substance, whether it's alcohol, sex, gambling, whatever. But there's a solution. You can rewire your brain in a healthier way, away from compulsive desire for something that in the end makes you a slave to it. Reasons for addiction. Why do we have addictions in the first place? Every one of us have some unique difference about our brain that makes it hard for us to adapt. Some people have social anxiety. With an imbalance in the GABA receptor, they may use alcohol, which hits the GABA receptor to ease their embarrassment in social situations. Similarly, people with attention deficit disorder, we haven't gotten to that chapter yet, may have disorders of dopamine, another neurotransmitter, so they may try to jerry-rig their brain into working by using substances that balance their neurochemistry, whether it's nicotine, caffeine, cocaine, or amphetamines. Individuals with ADHD shop around for a drug that sharpens their minds. Last but not least, people with depression might have problems with serotonin and, of course, eating carbohydrates, pasta, rice, bread, or sweets may make our bodies boost serotonin levels and lift our moods. as well as boost our waistlines. So is that it? Do you have to have anxiety, depression, or ADHD to have an addiction? Of course not. You don't have to have a diagnosis to misuse a substance to cover up some emotion that you're uncomfortable with. All of us have some emotion or other that we're uncomfortable with. So we troll the face of the earth to find something that helps us bide our time, makes it easier to be a human. Addictions have been around since probably the caveman or cavewoman. Probably cave dogs and cave cats as well. Have you noticed that when your dog or cat gets depressed, he hits the kibble more? Your brain pathways are some of the most primitive, pun intended, areas of your brain involving opiates and dopamine. Opiates and dopamine involve the most basic areas for survival: love, nurturance, relationships, and reward. If these needs aren't met, we simply don't feel alive. We might succumb to alcohol or drugs because our friends are using them. That's what they call the peer pressure part of addiction. Or we might find that we turn to alcohol, pills, or sex because we are in perpetual pain. Many people who've had minor surgery and have used oxycodone or Percocet find that they stay hooked on the drugs because they also remove the emotional pain of being in a bad relationship. Others are just bored with their lives, and the numbing or non-stimulating pain of boredom is easily replaced by the escapism of hallucinogens and other stimulating substances. Some people want to use substances to connect to the divine with peyote or other psychedelic substances. People since the beginning of time have used substances to seek a spiritual experience. Some people addictively involve themselves in spirituality in such a way that it supplants involvement in relationships, a productive vocation, and relationships on planet Earth in general. Ironically, the great psychiatrist and substance abuse expert, Abraham Twersky, a rabbi, said that our craving for the divine is the basis for addiction, that when we have a sense of the emptiness in our lives and boredom, we really don't know that emptiness is a lack of connection to spirit. To fill that inner craving we can't name, many people turn to drugs. We call this the spiritual anatomy of addiction. Addiction and medical intuition. According to medical intuition, addiction is a key part of our intuitive guidance system that lets us know we're having a hard time balancing ourself, our self-love, with our ability to handle work or responsibility to others. It's a third center issue. As you remember from the introduction, the health of the third center involves balancing our self-esteem or self-love with our ability to feel responsibility for others. If we have difficulty handling that balance, we're more likely to suffer from problems with weight, digestion, and body image, but also addiction. Whether it's diabetes, which is a pancreas problem, or the effects of alcohol on the liver, the stomach, or the pancreas, all things addiction are third center. In the brain, addiction involves opiates from the nucleus accumbens and dopamine from the ventral tegmentum. But reward doesn't just come from brain neurochemistry. We can feel reward from children, pets, work, activism in the world, our relationship, family, learning, spirituality, nature. Every emotional center and medical intuition has a source for reward. Mind-body health involves having happiness, a rewarding life, via multiple areas of our life. Like having a balanced stock portfolio, we have to have multiple areas that we invest ourselves in emotionally. If you find yourself only getting reward from one area, that is work or sex or helping people, you are in essence getting reward from only one center. Since there are seven centers in medical intuition, each one contributes 14% of our life. If all of your focus, for example, is on your relationship, second center, 14%, and it's hijacking your energy, so you have no other emotional, physical, or financial resources for the other centers, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 86%. Some label this a relationship addiction. Yes, you can have an artificial sense of reward or opiates when we do cocaine, gamble, have sex, or rescue others. However, you're not fooling yourself. If you don't have happiness and reward in multiple, balanced, healthy areas of your life, you'll soon suffer from addiction. The anatomy of love and addiction. Louise Hay says addiction is inner emptiness and damaged self-love. What is self-love anyway? You know what Tina Turner says in What's Love Got to Do with It? Is love a second-hand emotion? No, it's a first-hand emotion. When you're born, you look at your mother looks at you, and you start to develop self-love right then and there. The biology of self-love begins with opiates. Yes, it's that same neurotransmitter for addiction. Right away, from the very moment you're born, when you look at someone else and they look at you, the wiring for self-love begins to course through your brain and body. Then, when you develop language, all the words that you use for how you feel about yourself and others starts to wire self-love or self-esteem in your brain and body. If you say, I hate myself, or I hate my hips, or I hate my abdomen, I'm stupid, I'm dumb, your sense of self-love plummets, and so do your internalized opiates and dopamine. You may then try to import your neurochemistry of self-love artificially through food, through drugs, or through other addictions. This is the anatomy of trying to fake yourself into believing you love yourself, but it's not lasting. The drugs soon wear off. When that relationship leaves you and you're alone, you then have to face yourself, and that deep emptiness inside you exposes your lack of self-love. The antithesis of self-love is shame. Shame's believing you have something defective about you. Guilt, humiliation, whatever it is, you think something is wrong about you. I feel shame about my hips. I feel shame about my intellect. I feel shame about some aspect of my history that I feel is awful, is aberrant. And then you start to believe that other people think there's something wrong with you too. They're laughing at you. They're criticizing you. They're judging you. All of this becomes wired in your brain and your body. Low self-esteem, shame, criticism, blah, blah, blah. And then you end up trying to medicate this ball of bad emotions with addiction. Ultimately, a lack of self-love breeds low self-esteem, which breeds addiction. So, you may be able to take a fearless inventory of why you have a problem with addiction, whether it's food, drink, alcohol, drugs, gambling, sex, cigarettes, bad relationships, and so on. But ultimately, knowing why you have an addiction doesn't give you the skills to get rid of it. Knowing you're genetically prone to addiction, knowing you've had a traumatic past, knowing you've had a history of depression, anxiety, or ADHD, doesn't give you the skills to manage your addiction any more than knowing why you got that flat tire helps you to fix the tire. Change the tire now, and then figure out where the nail came from. Manage your addiction now, so it can give you the skills and the emotional resilience to be able to handle your past, if you even want to. Yes, it's true. If you look at the origins of your addiction, it can help to buffer your brain into place while you're getting addiction treatment. Some addiction is called dual diagnosis. That's right, two diagnoses, not one. For people who have anxiety and addiction, their dual diagnosis would mean that they are more likely to have alcohol addiction because alcohol hits the GABA receptor, influencing anxiety. Similarly, someone who has problems with sex addiction would be more likely to have problems with opiates. Finally, someone who has problems with overeating, especially comfort food, is probably more likely to have a history of trauma and depression. What do I mean by comfort food? In the event that you don't know what comfort food is, look it up on the web. In any case, often comfort foods are used addictively. They are the cornerstone of our current epidemic of obesity. 60% of the United States has a problem with obesity, and it's not because of a lack of information. Often, it's because food is being used to fill up that emptiness and self-esteem and disappointment about ourselves and about love we get from others. Look at what you're drawn to, addictively. The neurochemistry of it. Is it alcohol? Then chances are you're medicating anxiety. Is it potatoes, pasta, rice, Cinnabon? Then chances are you are medicating something else. Sadness, shame, lost love, irritability, distractibility, brain fog. The anatomy of craving tells you what the other side of your dual diagnosis is, what chemistry in your brain you're trying to solve. Addictions and affirmations. There are many kinds of addictions besides chemical ones. There are pattern addictions that we adopt to keep us from being present in our life, says Louise Hay. Business, distraction, work addiction, rescue addiction. By engaging all of this business, this chatter in our brain, we can crowd out that inner voice of spiritual and intuitive wisdom. Mindfulness helps us sit in silence, stop the chatter, and listen to that single voice of the divine or our soul. If you simply can't sit in silence, if you have to crowd your life with this chitter chatter of business, rescuing loud noises, then you're using pattern addictions to escape emotions you can't handle. Louise Hay has some positive affirmations for addiction. These include, we are each responsible for our experiences. Every thought we think is creating our future. Everyone is dealing with the damaging patterns of resentment, criticism, guilt, and self-hatred. These are only thoughts, and thoughts have been changed. We need to release the past and forgive everyone, including ourselves. Self-approval and self-acceptance in the now are the key to positive changes. The point of power is always in the present moment. And then she says, finally, if you're going to be addicted to anything, why not be addicted to yourself? After all, loving yourself will give you the chemistry of what you are craving anyway. Treating addictions. Traditionally, the first step in treating addiction is to restore, maybe even recover, a balanced brain chemistry and simultaneously suppress your urge to use a substance or do an unhealthy behavior. Many people think addiction is just getting you to stop drinking or doing drugs. However, that's not true. In medical intuition, addiction treatment is about third center rehab. It's rehabilitating your self-esteem, your self-love, but also your capacity to be responsible in the world, to uphold your responsibilities, not just to yourself, but to other people, your relationships, your family, your work, your bills, and so on. There are several prototypical treatments. The most common is the 12-step program. In a 12-step group, people recognize that their lives have become unmanageable and in partnership with a higher power. they submit to a series of cognitive and spiritual improvements. What does that mean? You rewire your brain and you get in contact with spirit or a power greater than you. Many people have a trouble with this concept. Well, a famous story that's been bantied around 12-step programs is this. A man stood up and said, "I don't know, I have trouble with this whole God spiritual power thing." So a woman stands up and says, "Would you agree that you ain't him?" The point is, you can probably agree that somewhere out there, there's a power greater than you. Another source of help for addiction is psychiatry, a dual diagnosis program. So, if you have depression and addiction, or anxiety and addiction, anger, ADHD, the list is very long, a psychiatrist or other licensed practitioner will help you pharmacologically treat that disorder, targeting GABA, dopamine, serotonin, and other medicines, and nutritional supplements. However, a reputable practitioner will only use nutritional supplements and medicines that are non-addictive. If you find yourself trying to go to another doctor and get another medicine because that pill won't give you the same buzz as your cocaine, that drug won't give you the same euphoria as oxycodone, etc., guess again, you are engaging in addictive behavior again. Most addiction treatment uses cognitive behavioral therapy and now dialectical behavioral therapy in addition to affirmations to change those thought patterns in your frontal lobe that take you away from self-love and into unbalanced ways of thinking and behavior. A technical term for this is relapse prevention. Last but not least, work and vocation are extremely important. If you don't have work, you will have a lot of time on your hands and you will get those cravings. In fact, work is the most potent medicine or drug for addiction. Why? Because rewarding work helps release opiates, that key neurochemical of addiction. You might say, "Well, I hate my work, so therefore I won't work." Wrong. What you need is a structured job that helps you get up and out the door. By having a stable schedule, you'll help reconstruct your biorhythms, those schedules for cortisol in your brain, and rehabilitate the pathways that have been hijacked by addiction. And while you're engaged in that job, you can work with a vocational counselor who can help you get the right education and training to start to approach an avocation or calling that's more in keeping with your dream career. And if work is your addiction, your vocational counselor will help you learn to engage with it in a healthy way. The best thing about working in a community, a support group, that helps with addiction is that it gives you, in fact, a family. Most addictions run in a family, and most people experience trauma as a result of being raised in a family of addiction. By being involved in a 12-step group, we get to have a prosthetic family, another family that helps rehabilitate our way of relating out from under the influence of a substance. Many people who have addiction have fallings out with their families of origin, lose their spouses, and become alienated from children. Learning how to make up for that injury that has happened in a relationship and build new bonds is essential for the treatment of addiction. The medicines. There are a variety of medicines used for a person staying in remission, whether it's Suboxone, methadone, naloxone, and so on. All of these medicines bind to the opiate receptor and reportedly make a person less likely to relapse. However, medicines alone are not going to change your behavior. It's well known that many people use any and all of these medicines and then still use the substance of abuse. The cornerstone of addiction is rehabilitating a person's third center, his or her self-love, self-image, responsibility to others, as well as to vocation, relationships, and family. Rome was not built in a weekend. Addiction recovery doesn't happen that way either. The truth is, no matter what kind of assistance you are receiving, most people fall in and out of treatment. Addiction, like any illness, has many stages. I'm not going to go through all the stages. Suffice it to say that any life-threatening illness, even cancer, has a variety of stages where a person goes in and out of remission. And addiction is a serious illness. People die from it, and the havoc it creates in the lives of the loved ones around the person with addiction is devastating. The treatment can be extremely expensive, can be very effective, and yet can take several rounds before it takes. Don't be discouraged. There is support out there. Exercises for change. In addition to the affirmations you read above, Louise offers some powerful tools to treat addiction. The first is an exercise called Release Your Addictions. This is when the changes take place, here and now in your own mind. Take some deep breaths, close your eyes, and think about the person, place, or thing you're addicted to. Think of the insanity behind the addiction. You are trying to fix what you think is wrong inside of you by grabbing onto something that is outside of you. The point of power is in the present moment, and you can begin to make a shift today. Once again, by being willing to release a need, say, I am willing to release the need for X, that's your addiction, in my life. I release it now and trust in the process of light to meet my needs. Say it every morning in your daily affirmations and prayers. You have taken another step to freedom. Another exercise that can help you forgive and release is your secret addiction. List 10 secrets that you never shared with anyone regarding your addiction. If you are an overeater, maybe you have eaten out of a garbage can. If you are an alcoholic, you may have kept alcohol in the car so that you could drink while driving. If you are a compulsive gambler, perhaps you put your family into jeopardy in order to borrow money to continue your addiction. List 10 secrets. How do you feel now? Look at your worst secret. Visualize yourself in this period of your life and love that person. Tell them how much you love and forgive. Look into the mirror and say, I forgive you and love you exactly as you are. Breathe. Many people have told Louise they can't enjoy today because of something that has happened in the past. But holding on to the past only hurts us. It means we're refusing to live in the moment. The past is over and cannot be redone. You can start releasing the past with an exercise called Ask Your Family. Let's go back to your childhood for a moment and ask a few questions. Fill in the blanks. 1. My mother always made me blank. 2. What I really wanted her to say was blank. 3. What she really didn't know was blank. 4. My father told me I shouldn't blank. 5. If my father only knew blank. 6. I wish I could have told my father blank. 7. Mother, I forgive you for blank. 8. Father, I forgive you for blank. And 9. What would you still like to tell your parents about yourself? What is the unfinished business that you still have? These exercises help you address your addiction and also help you address your self-esteem. In medical intuition, as we've seen, self-esteem and addiction are in the same center. By rewiring your self-esteem, you are mirroring the neurochemistry that you've been importing through your addiction. Try this exercise, self-approval, self-esteem, rehabilitation. Every time you think about your addiction for the next month, say over and over to yourself, "I approve of myself." Say this 300 or 400 times a day. No, it's not too many times. When you are worrying, you will go over your problem at least that many times in a day. Let "I approve myself" become a walking mantra, something that you say over and over to yourself almost non-stop. Saying "I approve myself" is guaranteed to bring up everything in your consciousness that is in that position. When a negative thought like "How can you approve of yourself? You spent all that money," or "You just ate 2 pieces of cake," or "You'll never amount to anything," or whatever your negative battle may be, this is the time to take mental control. Give it no importance. Just say the thought for what it is. Another way to keep you stuck in the past. Gently say to this thought, "Thank you for sharing. I let you go. I approve of myself." These thoughts of resistance will have no power over you unless you choose to believe them. The All Is Well Clinic, Part 1, The Eating Addictions. There are so many disorders of eating, whether it's simply binge eating versus anorexia, bulimia, compulsive eating, addictive eating, or simply out of control, imbalanced, obsessive-compulsive nutritional and dietary practices. It can be a product of trying to medicate one's depression, Chapter 1, anxiety, Chapter 2, attention problems, Chapter 4, or in the case of this chapter, addiction. I found in my 30-plus years working as a medical intuitive and in psychiatry, I find myself saying, more frequently than not, almost all roads end in addiction, meaning that all of us have some form of addiction. In this section, we discuss eating first because all of us have to do it, that is, eat. And therefore, food is probably the most common, abused, and misused substance that we have to cover up an emotion we can't handle. We all need food with which to exist, and as with work or relationships, we also need food to survive, thrive, and be healthy. Learning how to handle eating and drinking for satiety and sobriety is not always an issue. Some of us, genetically or by a quirk of fate, are able to get through life without having some form of disordered eating. However, given that 60% of, at least the United States, with the world rapidly catching up, is overweight, near obese, it's clear that addiction of disordered eating has wide ramifications to affect our health and longevity. Do the following statements apply to you? Mind symptoms. You're embarrassed about how much you eat or what you eat, so much that often you'll only eat certain foods alone. Often, after eating, you're disgusted with yourself, depressed, or feeling guilty. At times, you can find yourself eating an amount of food that's obviously larger than what most people eat during that time. Often, when you eat, you lack control and you can't stop. Go back to the beginning of the chapter and ask yourself the cage questions when it comes to your eating. Have you tried to cut back? Have you felt annoyed? Guilty about what and how much you eat? thinking about it first thing when you open your eyes? Chances are, food is an obsession for you. Your behavior around it is a compulsion, and your addictive use of it eventually is going to affect your health. Body symptoms. Physically, you can't stop eating until you feel uncomfortably full. Physically, you eat large amounts of food even when you're not hungry. Physically, you're not even aware when you are eating. You may find that before you know it, a whole bowl of popcorn or carton of ice cream is gone. You won't even remember where all those cookies went. It's as if your eating is on autopilot. If this is you, you're not alone and you know it. If you've ever been on a sports team or in a dorm, you're well aware of how much socialization goes around food and how, when people get stressed, they take breaks from their anxiety and immerse themselves in a bowl of popcorn, the ice cream, the chocolate chip cookies, and so on. And then, once we graduate, we leave the dorm, our groups and our buddies behind, we go off to live alone or with our partners, and we end up doing the same behaviors, often trying to secretly hide what we've been doing for years. That is, binging large amounts of food during times of anxiety or stress. Some of us do periodic cleanses to reset our metabolism from this excessive intake of calories, but after this fast of greatly reduced calories, we need to reward ourselves, which leads to another binge. And this is in our 20s and 30s. This cycle of stress, excessive eating, binge, shame, guilt, cleanse, this yo-yo up and down dieting distorts your metabolism as much as it distorts your brain circuits for mood, reward, body image, and self-esteem. And then, by the time you hit 40 and 50 and your hormones start to change, you're left with a Bermuda Triangle of disrupted metabolism, disrupted brain circuits for eating and addiction, disrupted mood, anxiety, inattention, not to mention hormones. Keep listening to the following case for a problem that so much of us are oh so familiar with. Jill, binge eating. Jill, 32, called me because she was having trouble losing weight. The intuitive reading. When I looked at Jill's life, I saw early in her life that she had been a scapegoat in her family. It felt like she had had a falling out with the major person in charge, someone who felt like a king or a queen. Jill felt like she was the one singled out for criticism and shame. No matter what she did, it was never good enough. The body. Jill's mind felt like a hummingbird that never rested. Her posture appeared to slump, and I sensed a lump in her throat. Her lower extremities felt like lead. I saw that she craved carbohydrates like pasta, rice, bread, or sweets to soothe moodiness, irritability, and sadness. The moodiness and irritability seemed to make her adrenal gland convert body fat to estrogen and cortisol that affected her breast tissue and her hormones. I saw that she had blood sugar swings. The facts. Jill told me she ate compulsively and had spent many years hiding food from her roommates. Struggling with her weight all of her life, she managed to lose 70 pounds and then gain it all back. Recently, her mother had rejected Jill for marrying a man because she hated him. Her mother's exact words were, "You're dead to me now." Since she married her husband, Jill had been totally ostracized by her family. And after her wedding, that's when the pounds really began to pile on. And Jill developed hormonal problems too. When she developed two breast lumps, the doctors said they were related to excess weight. In the United States, obesity and weight problems are at the top of the list. When most people talk about their health, they really talk about their weight. They talk about knee pain, lower back pain, ankle issues, breast lumps, heavy menstrual flow, digestive symptoms, hypertension, and cholesterol. but they rarely talk about their weight when they list their health problems. And weight, or excessive body fat, is usually the one cause of any or all of these problems. If you have problems with weight, chances are you've tried over and over to lose it. You're embarrassed or frustrated if someone brings it up. And although you've spent years, perhaps decades, of your life feeling guilty when you do eat, you've already done everything you can to try to lose the weight or the body fat. So, when it comes to thinking about your health, somehow weight doesn't come on the list because it's such a frustrating problem. You just try to put it out of your mind. It's as if all the other issues in your health, the breast lumps, the knee pain, the ankle pain, hypertension, or at least something you could do something about with medicines, nutritional supplements, herbs. Because the solution to your weight has thus far eluded you and millions of other people, though you actually have heard of people handling and healing these other health problems. So you focus in on something you're going to be able to solve. And if you have problems with weight, chances are, if you don't already, you will at some point have problems with chronic pain. For every 10 pounds you're overweight, it puts 40 pounds of force on your back, your knees, and your ankles. And over the years, if your weight continues to go up, your disability will increase. The leading cause of disability for people who are obese is knee osteoarthritis. Whether it's arrhythmias or cardiovascular disorders or total body inflammation, all of these disorders can be made better if we lose weight. But how? The solution. If you are like Jill and all the rest of us, your weight problems can never be solved with just nutritional counseling. Weight is a complex brain-body disorder similar to addiction. Science has started to look at the weight loss problem and has seen that all weight problems are not the same. Some people have high insulin. Other people have difficulty responding to a sense of fullness while eating. Other individuals cannot prevent themselves from eating that tempting cupcake or French fry if they see it, while other people just follow the eating patterns of high calorie, fat, sugar, and salt that they learned as children. Some individuals, the subject of this chapter, have binge eating disorders and food addiction. And finally, some people have difficulty with being active or find a lot of value in being sedentary. We can't lump all people with weight problems in one category. This helps explain why all treatments do not help all people lose weight. If you have problems losing weight, it may be important for you to engage with a weight loss specialist or bariatric center to find out which one of these categories you fall under. By getting a thorough physical examination, you can find out if you have a problem with insulin, problems with feeling fullness. Working with a nutritionist, you might find out whether you have difficulty withstanding food temptations or breaking familial patterns of bad eating. Working with a counselor, a healthcare practitioner, and or a dialectic behavioral therapist, you can learn the skills to balance your emotions and thoughts so they don't result in addictive behavior. Specifically, dialectic behavioral therapy can help you use mindfulness to soothe guilt, anger, and sadness, identify the thought patterns that make you feel bad about yourself, and react in the present in such a way that you don't use food compulsively to soothe emotions instead. Dialectical behavioral therapy is a class and a coach, so you'll get individual and group support in your struggle. And many eating disorder clinics use dialectic behavioral therapy as well to teach people life skills for creating healthier eating patterns. Eating, self-image, and the brain. A whole book can be written about food and the mind. I won't bore you with all those details, but I cannot underestimate the impact of eating, mood, anxiety, self-esteem, and disordered eating. There are lifetime effects on the brain and body. So bear with me. If you learn how eating is wired in your brain, you will learn how to master this day-to-day function using medicine, intuition, and affirmations. A lot of people have shame about eating, weight, and their self-image. In medical intuition, weight is a third center issue. A lot of women always see themselves as heavy despite being normal weight. How we see ourselves, our degree of normal weight, may parallel how lovable we sense we are. Some people believe that their sense of lovableness is proportionate to how physically attractive they see themselves as in the mirror. What you need to know is that, just like a carnival funhouse mirror, the visual areas in your brain actually distort how you look in the mirror. Now you might begin to see how the three-dimensional image you perceive of your body has to be disconnected in your brain from your sense of self-love. Seriously, it bears repeating. Literally, it is possible for the brain areas for vision to widen your hips beyond how wide they really are, distort or distend the volume of your abdomen beyond what it really is, elongate your nose way beyond its actual length, and so on. If you've had a history of trauma, if someone has treated you in a hateful way, the brain sometimes has a peculiar way of handling that hate that came toward you. Rather than taking the negative feeling and deflecting it out of you, your brain absorbs it and combines it into your own three-dimensional perception of what you look like. So therefore, when you're a child and someone says repeatedly, "You're ugly, I hate you, you're stupid, I don't want you," your brain absorbs it like a paper towel absorbs a spill. Your brain gets saturated with that hate and you learn that you are undesirable. And that undesirability becomes reflected like a mirror on parts of yourself, the nose, the hips, the abdomen, the pelvis. All those individual parts become a reflection of all the parts of you that you heard were unlovable. And all those statements of unlovability coalesce into that image you see in the mirror. The way you are unloved becomes a distorted perception of how you think your body is unlovable. And when you say to yourself in the present, "I hate my hips, I hate my abdomen, I hate my breasts," you are reenacting the past. You are hating on yourself, and your body is hearing it and absorbing it and further distorting your image in the mirror. It's like a reverse affirmation, like a negative version of Louise Hay's mirror work. You're not improving your self-esteem, you're lowering it. If this is you, if you hate or even strongly dislike your image, however you look at it, you may turn to food to seek love and comfort. The brain, eating, and excess weight. Many people think being overweight is a problem that registers in your body, but it's truly a mind-body problem. If you have trouble with your weight, understand it's not just about self-image and self-esteem. It's also a biochemical misarrangement of dopamine, opiates, and other areas of the addiction network. Let's look at the brain areas that have to do with regulating eating. Drug companies are trying to target molecules like leptin, ghrelin, and others. Molecules that regulate our sense of fullness after eating or desire to eat more. These drugs are targeted to artificially make us feel full before we really are, so we'll eat less, or to block our appetite in the first place. Most of the studies have shown, though, that drugs directed against leptin and ghrelin don't work for very long. Why? Because if you only focus on the body and weight and ignore emotions and addiction, you'll lose the battle. That said, there are some treatments that really help when you actually have a serious weight problem. Serious obesity, when people are more than 80 to 100 pounds overweight, can shorten your lifespan by 10 or more years. Ultimately, by the time you get to that amount of weight, a more dramatic immediate solution is needed. Ghrelin receptors are located in the stomach lining. For some people, bariatric surgery can be extremely effective because it reduces the size of the stomach, reduces the area that produces ghrelin, and may trick the brain's metabolism areas. Am I saying everyone should go out and have bariatric surgery? Hell no. Absolutely not. What I am saying is for some people, a band procedure may be what is necessary to save their lives. It's up to you and your physician to decide what is the next most effective step in managing your weight long term. But whether you decide to have bariatric surgery or not, you're still going to have to address the brain-body chemistry and the self-esteem and self-image components of addiction. In the end, we all see drugs for weight loss come and go. Who hasn't heard of fen-phen, fenfluramine, fenteramine, which was all the rage in the 80s? This drug helped people lose weight, but it also caused a life-threatening lung disease, pulmonary hypertension, so it was taken off the market. Any drug you take has its effects and its side effects, and a drug to reduce weight does as well. Which leads me to stimulants. Stimulants like Adderall and others have long been used by certain individuals to lose weight. However, after the first 5 pounds, people rarely lose significant amounts of weight, and then they're stuck on this medicine, which can increase the chance over time for hypertension and other heart problems. When it comes to the brain, there are ways to reduce appetite using nutritional supplements, herbs, medicine, intuition, and affirmations. First, address the variety of food. If you want to lose weight, you're better off eating the same thing every day. I know you're probably saying, but that's boring. Right. You'll be bored all the time to losing a lot of weight. Diets that involve eating more or less the same food every day reduce dopamine stimulation and reward areas, reduce your appetite, and as a result, you lose weight. And although you say, I don't want to eat the same food every day, it is an effective way to lose weight. Here's an effective and reasonable meal plan to rewire your brain and body toward healthy weight. Notice, I'm not using the D word, diet. That word probably increases your anxiety and frustration right away, which makes your adrenal gland release cortisol, which of course increases insulin and ultimately weight. Instead, I suggest the following meal plan, which is similar to the plan I outlined in Chapter 1. To stabilize your blood sugar and prevent you from feeling deprived, eat at pretty much the same time every day. For breakfast, have a bowl of whole oats. If you're not allergic to dairy, drink half a glass or a full glass of low-fat milk. Have a cup of coffee, and then have a bottle of water which you drink down like a shot. Then, exercise for half an hour with the tension turned all the way down on an elliptical trainer or exercise bicycle to a techno or disco beat. You can do yoga, Pilates, strength training, all you want, any other time during the day, but you have to do your half hour of cardio, as they say. At 10 o'clock in the morning, you have a half of a protein bar, not whole, half, and your second bottle of water, which you gulp down. You gulp the water down because it elicits a gastrocolic reflex, which makes your colon dump digested food, thus decreasing reabsorption of fats and estrogen. Noon is your biggest meal of the day. No, it's not dinner. If you want to have the rest of your day to move around and not feel sluggish, lunch should be your meal of maximum volume. You take a normal dinner plate and you divide it into thirds. One-third protein, one-third carbs, one-third vegetable. If you want dessert of any kind, you take some of the carbohydrate away and have half a piece of dessert. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you have the other half of that protein bar you had at 10 and your third and final bottle of water. Mind you, this is your last carbohydrate. Dinner, no later than 6 p.m. It's a dessert plate. A small piece of protein, a dark leafy vegetable, but no carbohydrate. If you want to walk after dinner, you'll lose the weight. If you have trouble sticking to this, consider joining a support group like Curves or Jenny Craig or something of that nature so that the group support and the presence of other people can keep you on task. Work with someone who does cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical behavioral therapy to teach you strategies of mindfulness to soothe anxiety, depression, or anger so you won't use food to calm yourself. The affirmations. Louise uses the following affirmations for binge eating and problems with weight. Obesity can have to do with fear, needing protection, running away from feelings. The affirmation for this is, I am at peace with my own feelings. I am safe where I am. I create my own security. I love and approve of myself. That fear may also be resistance to forgiveness. The affirmation for this is, I am protected by divine love. I am always safe and secure. I am willing to grow up and take responsibility for my life. I forgive others, and I now create my own life the way I want. I am safe. High blood sugar reflects a longing for what might have been, a sense that no sweetness is left. The affirmation is, this moment is filled with joy. I now choose to experience the sweetness of today. For depression, the affirmation is, I now go beyond other people's fears and limitations. I create my own life. Anxiety is not trusting the flow and the process of life. The affirmation is, I love and approve of myself. I trust the process of life. I am safe. For attention problems, hyperactivity, feeling pressured and frantic, the affirmation is, I am safe. All pressure dissolves. I am good. 2. Addiction to being thin. When it comes to having a history of trauma, you don't just bring the trauma of the past pain. When we experience a very painful childhood or a series of emotionally, physically, or sexually abusive relationships, we tend to, like Pac-Man, eat those memories and incorporate them into areas of our body. Just as in the previous section about distorted body image, hateful acts toward us can become memorialized in our eating behavior. True, we had no control in that traumatic experience in our past, but now we're going to feel more in control of our environment, especially our body, through how we handle our food. The anxiety that comes with PTSD is soothed by a compulsive need to control the one thing that we can. That is, your body and food. You couldn't control that parent who was abusing you. You couldn't control what that painful partner was saying or doing to you. So at least you can control the grams of fat and carbohydrates you consume, not to mention the pounds or kilograms that register on the scale. And the depression that one tends to experience with trauma becomes medicated addictively through extreme restriction of calories. Whether it's binging and then purging, or anorexia, deprivation of calories induces opiates, which is the same neurochemical found in addiction. So if we have a problem with needing to be perfectly thin, and then even more perfectly thin, we need to look at whether we are medicating a history of past trauma with obsessions and compulsions around food and elevating our mood via extremely low calorie intake and metabolism. If you think this may be you, or you're not sure, together with a friend, listen to this list of emotional patterns around food. Mind symptoms. You have an intense fear of gaining weight. You have obsessive thoughts of becoming fat, even though you are lower than the following weight calculation. You start at 100 pounds, and for every inch of height, over 5 feet, you add 5 pounds. So, for example, someone who's 5 feet tall would weigh an average of 100 pounds, more or less. Someone who's 5'5" would weigh on the average 125, again, more or less. So, if someone who's 5'5" and 125 pounds has obsessive thoughts and worries about being fat, this may be an area of concern. Behavior symptoms. You tend to go from one food plan to another, one diet to another, where you are greatly restricting your energy intake to a significantly lower and lower body weight for your age, height, and gender. You're constantly trying to cut down on your food. People have been annoyed by you constantly cutting down your food and trying to lose weight. They say you don't need to lose weight. You're already too thin. When you eat even healthy fruit and vegetables and protein, you feel guilty and feel you need to cut back. When you wake up in the morning, the first thing you think about when you open your eyes is your weight and how little food you can eat that day. Yes, this is the CAGE questionnaire.